There's a lot to say when buying a new home or car, but only one thing to say that can help you protect them. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there. And just like that, a State Farm agent will be there to help you choose the coverage you need, no matter where you are in life. When you need coverage options, your State Farm agent is there to help, on the phone or in person. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there. This episode is brought to you by Noom. Forget one-size-fits-all diets. With Noom, you get a personalized weight loss plan that's tailored to your lifestyle. No food is off limits. Enjoy your favorites while discovering healthier habits. Noom's users love the flexible approach, blending psychology and biology to help you lose weight in a way that's sustainable for you. Stay focused on what's important to you with Noom's psychology and biology-based approach. Sign up for your trial today at Noom.com. That's N-O-O-M. And check out Noom's first ever cookbook, The Noom Kitchen, for 100 healthy and delicious recipes to promote better living. Available to buy now wherever books are sold.
Welcome to the Nerds Podcast number 641. I will be performing in Chicago this weekend at the Athenaeum Theater.
The Windy Apple.
I don't know why that's the funniest thing I've heard all week. I think tickled would be the word, Jonah Ray. I'll be performing in the... on February 27th. Two shows. Go to funcomfortabletour.com.
City of brotherly hugs.
the Sunshine Brothers. The Mile Low City.
Yeah.
good times. Do you have anything to that you want to let people know about?
No, I don't think so.
The Meltdown with Jonah and Kamel.
The Meltdown with Jonah and Kamel. Every Wednesday at Meltdown Comics. And we're gearing up for our second season on Comedy Central.
So great.
Yeah, and I'm co-releasing the cassette version of Kyle Clark's album
Pizza Night.
Pizza
you sure
Night.
Are. Thanks for doing that.
Yeah, so I'm helping him put that out.
Fantastic, Kyle.
Yeah, and Wiener Records as well.
Yes.
Anything on the Nerdist Community Corkboard?
Yeah. I got a good one here that is from Trent Murray. His wife lost her job to fibromyalgia. Which is a disease, and that's no good. But she actually started doing, like, she went crazy just being stuck sick at home.
Yeah, these are supposed to be fun, right? Fun activities.
No, but it's good because, like, she started an Etsy page where she makes stuff, and she does arts and crafts stuff that she's selling. And she does, like, dice holders that look like animals for, like, RPG stuff.
Oh, that's rad.
And it's called, her page is Etsy/shop/owls, and the letter N, orchids.
You sure you mean backslash?
You mean the forward one instead?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, backslash is for local files.
You mean the forward one instead? Or any of the other options of slashes?
Oh, like, I went to all these backslashes and I couldn't find this woman's Etsy store on my local drive.
Yeah. So do the HTTP colon.
So it's on Etsy. Her Etsy name is Owls and Orchids. I keep wanting to say ostrich. Owls and orchids.
And the letter N or and?
N. The letter
owls
N.
Owls and orchids.
In and out.
So that's good. So, yeah, so great. So by going to the Tesla store, you're actually supporting someone who is making the best out of a nasty situation.
And it's she's got cool stuff.
Good.
So I'm a big fan of that.
Okay, what else on the corkboard?
Something else. I think this is rad, which is TypeCon.
Yes.
It's a type. It's
a typeface convention?
It's a typeface convention.
Wow.
That's fantastic.
And I hear rumor that Helvetica might be coming in to be the guest of honor.
Hell fucking
did they say that or did
no,
you make
I made that
joke? Okay,
I made
just
that
checking.
TypeCon.com, TypeCon.com the website for it. It's in Denver this year, so you can go to Denver and then
look
at typefaces.
That's,
right?
I would do
I'm
that.
I'm super down for this. I think it sounds like pretty cool.
Like, you know, can I tell you, sometimes when I'm staying in a hotel and then you'll, you know, like they'll leave a plate of cookies or something and with like you'll get a note from the manager that'll say like, welcome to the hotel. I hope you enjoy your stay. some of these people have the best handwriting that I've ever seen, and agreed. I always think I'm going to go down and give them $100 to write out the alphabet in upper and lower case, and I'm gonna vectorize it.
Oh, that'd be nice. Rad.
That'd be pretty cool.
But I haven't done that yet.
Could I plug a personal thing?
Well, is it a leak?
I kind of already did.
Yeah, what do you want to plug?
I have a podcast.
What?
Right? It's called This Is Rad.
It'll never
been
work.
Working on it
What's
for about 6 months now. And I'm real proud of doing it with Matthew Burnside.
Yeah.
He's my co-host with it. We talk about things that we're excited about. And it's a podcast about things people have enthusiasm for.
Oh, my gosh.
Because the internet's full of people who shit on everything forever. So we're trying to bring people who enjoy things.
The only person who seemingly has more enthusiasm for life than me.
Right.
Kyle Clark.
It's a good time being this full of enthusiasm.
Kyle Clark is rad on Twitter.
Yeah. And This Is Rad.
When's
podcast.
It dropping?
It's out weekly. It comes out on Tuesdays. It's on iTunes and Stitcher.
Congratulations.
We did a fun one where we went to the Renaissance Fair with a mobile recording unit and just like walked around and talked to people in character and made a whole fun day out of it. It was a good time.
Good job.
Thank you. It's fun.
Fuck yeah, positivity, Kyle.
You're like singing to the choir. I'm tired of people complaining about stuff.
This episode is Brian Cox, who is a...
Speaking of positivity, this might be one of my favorite episodes you guys have ever done.
Really?
I was not here when you guys recorded it, and for the longest time I was like, oh, we're having that actor on, and when it was the scientist. The conversation when you guys get into like the quantum theory stuff, I was riveted. This is fascinating. Definitely probably one of my top five Nerdist podcasts.
Brian Cox is it. Well, that pleases me to hear. Maybe you could put it on your podcast.
Yeah, well.
We'll just start eating our own tail. But Brian is a scientist and a presenter and a writer, and he works at CERN. And he's brilliant, and he has a podcast called The Infinite Monkey Cage. InfiniteMonkeyCage.com is the website. They're touring. It's Brian and then a British comic by the name of Robin Ince. So Brian was here. Robin did not show up, but right before he got here...
This better be good.
I got a text. Hey, is it all right if my friend comes along whose name happens to be Eric Idle?
Oh, never mind.
Yeah. So Eric Idle happened to be here and just sat in on the podcast and was awesome. Eric was here when we did the What About Dick panel with him and Billy Connolly and Eddie Izzard. And so he sat in and we just talked about science. We fucking talked about science with Brian and Eric Idle. What an insane
That's like a weird fever
day.
Dream you'd have.
Yeah. I had the craziest dream. That would never happen. Well, it did happen. And they were fucking phenomenal. So it was, I mean, it was an honor to have them. Eric's going to be on one of the Infinite Monkey Cage live shows. Ooh. So again, InfiniteMonkeyCage.com. It's Nerds Podcast number 641 with Brian Cox and Eric Idle.
Now entering Nerdist.com.
All right. It's happening.
Welcome to the podcast, guys.
Welcome to the podcast, Brian Cox. And you've brought a friend with you, I see.
Yeah, my landlord.
Oh, it seemed appropriate.
Yeah, I can't afford to stay in a hotel, so I snoop around. I wander around Hollywood knocking on doors. And this was the first person who opened it.
Well, I think it's very nice. And what is your name, sir?
My name's Eric Idle.
Yay!
And I run a small boarding house in Hollywood.
For wayward physicists?
For wayward scientists in search of selling tickets.
The home for the bewildered scientists.
You do or you do not run a boarding house unless it is observed by
Ooh,
the physicists.
True. Yeah.
So you're simultaneously, you do and don't run a boarding
wow,
house.
That's
linear
right.
Superposition.
Yes.
Super.
Oh, it's starting
linear
early.
Superposition.
A linear superposition.
Yes.
Yeah.
It's wonderful to meet you, by the way. I'm a fan of your work, and I also... I'm aware of your music career.
Really?
Yes, of course.
That goes back a long way. It's my first visit to LA, actually. So you might be referring to D-Ream or Dare, the previous band I was in.
Yes.
We recorded an album here in 1987, I think it was, or maybe 86.
Which album did you record here?
It was Out of the Silence.
Wow.
Which was... actually mainly at Joni Mitchell's house, because her husband at the time was a great musician called Larry Klein, and he co-produced it.
Did you knock on doors asking for to record?
We wandered around Hollywood. It's been really successful.
So far you got Joni Mitchell and Eric Idle. Yeah. You should keep knocking on doors. President Obama,
come on right in.
Don't you get past the gate?
Yeah, it's easy now. Anyone can get on the White House lawn. It's not hard. At what point did you decide that you were going to give up music and pursue science?
It was the other way around, actually. I'd always wanted to be an astronomer, always wanted to do science from the age of 4 or 5, particularly astronomy. And then at the age of 16 or so, I got sort of slightly distracted because I discovered girls after stars, basically.
Yes.
And then thought, that's interesting. So did my phone just go off then?
It maybe did.
How unprofessional is that? There we are. So I got distracted slightly into music, and I was never a musician. I learned to play in order to be in a band. I had no interest in the art of music. Wow. I had no interest. I just wanted to be in a band. Bizarrely, it was the knocking on doors thing again, actually. This is true. This bit's actually true. Down the road from me in Oldham, near Manchester, the keyboard player of Thin Lizzy moved in to that. And so I did actually literally knock on his door and give him a demo tape through my dad, actually. I think we met him in the pub. So I gave him a demo tape. And then when Lizzy split up in sort of 84, 85, whenever it was, he called me up and said, do you want to be in my band? And I was just on my way to university. And I said, yeah, okay, I'll take a year off. And then the band got signed and we ended up touring with Jimmy Page.
You're sort of like an inverse Forrest Gump, where you're actually incredibly smart and you still stumble across all these bizarre...
Anti-Gump.
You're kind of an anti-Gump.
Yeah.
And so you did music for a while up until, I think, was the last one was like 93, maybe, early 90s?
Yeah, the band D-Ream. And then it came back in 97 when we Tony Blair, of all people, used our song to get elected back in 97. And I have to apologize for that now. So I apologize to your listener. But that was the sort of last thing that I did. And then
wow.
But that's the idea. I'd always wanted to do science.
And how did you and Eric meet?
I bumped into him through a mutual friend. Actually, I want to say I knocked on your door. I think we should perpetuate that myth.
You knocked on my door.
I literally knocked on his door.
It was actually from What About Dick?
Yes,
which is a thing that Arnold was laying on at the Orpheum, and he was brought by Joe Boxer, weren't you?
Yes. Yeah,
an underwear manufacturer.
Yeah,
you know Joe Boxer.
I do. Yeah.
Yeah. Well. We were mutually introduced
by an underwear manufacturer.
Yeah, and it was fun. Yeah, and then Billy Connolly was there. We had a lot of fun. We talked about space immediately, didn't we?
Yeah.
You've been filming with an octopus.
That's right. I'd been for Wonders of Life, a previous series. I'd been the wonderful underwater sequence with an octopus, and I raised my fist to this octopus accidentally. I wasn't trying to threaten the octopus, but it mimicked what I did. And so I started swimming towards it with my fist raised, and it raised two of its legs, and so I had a wonderful time with an octopus. So it's the only thing I won't eat. No, I've decided.
You didn't fight it and go, fuck you, humans rule? Or
well, yeah.
That's a very American attitude.
Oh, I'm sorry. Okay. I thought that's what you're supposed to... Whenever you see a thing that you don't recognize, you're supposed
you
to beat
it. You can't fuck it or eat it. Americans are not really interested.
We're not interested. Yeah. I don't want to know about it. So you just talk to it?
Get back to where you came from in that deep ocean.
I just love the idea of Eric Idle sitting in the corner for all of our podcasts when we do a slightly American idea. He just leans in and just lets us know.
It's not fucking a reading. You don't understand it.
He's right. He's right, everyone. Can we shoot it?
So when was the episode you're working with octopus, the octopi. Was it octopus-centric, or you were just underwater and you happened to stumble across?
Wonders of Life. It was about, that program was about the evolution of... eyes in particular, the fact that eyes have evolved many times, and the octopus's eyes are different to ours in a very interesting way, actually. The photosensitive cells are the same as the ones we have deep in our brains that are a part of our clock, our internal clock. Whereas our cells, the cells of the type that are in our eyes, it uses for a clock. So they're reversed around to somewhere in its evolutionary past, hundreds of millions of years ago. These two different kinds of light sensor got used for different things in us and the octopus.
So you mean how eyes are irreducibly complex and Jesus made eyes 7,500 years ago? No, is that
not
what you mean?
That's not what I mean at
oh,
all.
Okay, okay.
6,500 years, Chris?
6,500 years ago.
Yes, no, yes, it's 5,000 years ago.
It's 5,000 years ago.
But they're a very good example of an intelligent organism that evolved completely separately to us. If you trace a common ancestor back between us and an octopus, it's 500 million years ago or something like that. It's a long, long, long time ago. But yet you've got this thing that's relatively intelligent. It's got eyes which are as different to ours, but as good in many ways. So it's a fascinating animal.
It's really good at picking the World Cup. Remember that octopus?
Yes, that's right.
That was a misunderstanding of statistics.
an octopus that spoke German.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's already, octopus!
Yeah. Yeah. You say, raise one of your legs, depending on which team will win. Yeah. We'll get it right. You know, half the time. That's surprising. 50% of the time, the coin toss came up heads.
You know, can you imagine? 50% of the time.
Yeah.
Well, they're saying it's now not... The flip of a coin is not exactly 50-50 I just read a study today, due to the weight of the coin being heavier on the head side.
Depending which coin, obviously.
Yeah, they were going with
whose
the
head has
quarter.
Been chiseled into it.
Yeah, it was Washington.
Washington has a big head.
Huge.
And those wooden teeth.
Yep.
That are weighing it down every time you flip the coin.
And that poofy wig.
The English dentist.
So... Every time, so when you go into Wonders of Life, is there a certain amount that you feel like you already know, or are you going into it as inquisitive as someone who would be watching the series, and your whole goal is to learn as much as you can during the process?
No, I mean, Wonders of Life is a good example of me learning a lot, because it's a physicist take on biology, essentially, that series. And it came from a book. There's a book by Schrödinger. So we're talking about linear superpositions. Mm-hmm. There's a book by Schrödinger called What is Life that he wrote when he was in Dublin in the 40s. And so it's after he'd done all his work on quantum mechanics, he started thinking about the subcentral paradox of life, which is how do you get these ordered structures, things like human brains, from the laws of nature, which the basic law of physics, second law of thermodynamics, says that everything tends to disorder. So how is it that in a universe that is on the large scale tending to disorder, you can get these islands of order that are so complex, things like human brains. And so it's a fascinating book. And in it, he predicted the existence of DNA, where he said that there has to be, he called it an aperiodic crystal. So there must be some molecule that carries information from generation to generation. And Crick and Watson, who I think you knew, Eric, didn't you?
I've met Watson.
Yeah. You were mistaken for Watson.
I was mistaken for Dr. Watson by Deepak Chopra.
the ultimate.
How far seeing was he at the time when he mistook me for Deepak? Oh, Dr. Watson, I was such a big fan of yours when I was in college becoming a doctor. I said, you're talking to me, right? He's 85. You know, I was. Anyway, let us not abuse Deepak too much.
Let's. Yeah, I tweeted to Deepak, actually. I said you should come to the Infinite Monkey Cage, which I'm also...
Your podcast.
To promote the podcast and the live shows, which are going to be, I should say, here in LA. They're going to be the 12th of March.
Excellent.
You're going to see us live. But I was promoting it to Deepak.
And Eric?
I'm going to be in it.
What?
You're going to be in it for money?
I'm going to be singing the song for him.
Which song are you going to sing?
I wrote the theme song for them.
Oh, my God, that's awesome. Oh, you're going to do it live. You're going to do it live.
It's recorded with me and Jeff Lynn.
Hello.
It gets more crazy.
Yeah.
It's in the style. You won't know, George Formby. So you could do a brief George Formby impression, couldn't you?
Not here, no. It's not really
quantum mechanics.
but they can play the track. They can get the track and play it in.
Oh, that's true. So there's an old English entertainer called George Formby who used to play ukulele. And so we have a theme song which is about quantum mechanics, inflationary cosmology, and the great existential questions in the style of a 1920s ukulele player produced by Jeff Lynne.
Of course.
So why wouldn't you?
That's a lot of layering. That is a lot of layering.
But I said to Deepak, I tweeted to him, because he tweeted to me because I said he was a diamond encrusted guru or something, because he has those glasses with diamonds in them, and I thought that was not really a guru-like behavior.
Right.
And he sent a tweet to me saying something like, "I'll give you vast amounts of money if you'll come to my conference." And I said, "Money can't buy you knowledge, Deepak. You should know that."
Oh!
As a guru. But then I sent him a tweet and said, "You're welcome to come to the Infinite Monkey Cage live shows. The tickets are available." You know, he's got diamonds in his glasses. He can afford to buy a ticket for my show.
Right.
So, but he hasn't. As far as I know, he hasn't bought one yet. Maybe
what?
He'll surprise me. Maybe he'll surprise me. I said you might learn something about quantum theory and how woo-free it is.
Did you? did he respond?
And a vicious cloud of unguru-like vitriol.
Really?
Yeah.
I was not aware of this.
Oh, he gets very annoyed on Twitter.
Why? But he's supposed to be peaceful, I thought.
His peace is one tweet deep.
Oh, shit.
one jazz stick deep.
Wow.
That's
incredible. I would love to see a
vitriol. I can do it now, actually. All I have to do is tweet him and call him a woo merchant. And I get a little bit. We can probably do it live on air.
Delightful. I love this.
Is that fun for you to watch? Is it fun for you just to sort of poke a little bit?
Yeah, I love it. I do love it. I mean, that's the idea behind Monkey Cage in a way, because it's comedians and scientists together. So it's biased. Absolutely, the BBC sometimes struggle with this because it's an utterly biased show. It's biased towards reality.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a show that's biased towards reason, reality, critical thinking, and it has no time for any kind of drivel and nonsense.
Sure.
And that's the tension that sits at the heart of the show. So we have the scientists and we have a comedian usually, and we get letters of complaint all the time. We even get complaint about the title. We got a letter of complaint that said that we were promoting cruelty to animals by calling the program the Infinite Monkey Cage.
Because they were taking it as a literal monkey cage?
But even if it was literal, it's roomy.
Because it's infinite.
Arguably, the universe could be considered to be an infinite cage.
Could it be a TARDIS?
We'll get into that. We got a great letter saying, "You are referring to the Darwinian myth." The Darwinian myth.
Sure.
That monkeys, if you got monkeys and typewriters and sat them down,
right,
then they would type
eventually
out the complete works
of
Shakespeare.
Right.
And they said, "There's an experiment been done." And my friend Robin Ince said, "I like the experiment. It's data. We like data. Let's have a look." So we look further down the letter, and it said there was an experiment done in a zoo in Alabama or somewhere where they got 10 monkeys and 10 typewriters and put them there for a week, and all they did was shit on them. So there you go. Therefore, it's all disproven and evolution didn't happen.
Or they thought Shakespeare was shit. They were making a very artistic...
Yeah, and we said, no, there's a difference. There's a scale issue here that 10 is not close to infinity.
Right.
Right. It's not an incremental process where if you get 10 monkeys, you get a leaflet. And if you get 100, you get kind of, you know... What's that novel, that thing of the Shades of Grey thing? That's
50 Shades of Grey, sure.
That if you have 100 monkeys.
I believe that monkeys wrote that.
100, yeah.
Yeah, I'm on board for that.
How many? 100?
One. Two,
one.
One monkey wrote
one
that.
One monkey.
Yeah.
It had to be broken tied up to write it.
A couple monkeys. Yeah. It had to be forced. The monkey didn't want to do it.
Yes.
No one's going to buy this.
No.
Repurposed Twilight fan fiction. This idea of humanism, I think, is very interesting. And I think it's something that people... If they don't believe in the sort of the religious upbringings that a lot of us have, but I think it's the idea that that we as humanity are really sort of the kind of magical, not literally magical, but like that's where we should really focus our belief system is in humanity.
Yeah, well, it's interesting. I mean, the series I've just finished actually with the BBC was called Human Universe, and it's a cosmology series, but it became a love letter to the human race in a sense, because the central idea was that what perspective does cosmology give you? Well, on one side, obviously, it makes you feel very small and insignificant. I mean, there are 200 billion stars in the Milky Way galaxy, 350 billion galaxies in the observable universe, and the universe may well, and almost certainly does extend way beyond that and could be infinite in extent. So we're absolutely physically insignificant, it's true. But you can make an argument, especially from the biological side, actually, that intelligent civilizations are extremely rare things. And you can actually make an argument that there may be only one at the moment in the Milky Way. There's undoubtedly, there must be thousands of civilizations out there in the universe, millions, perhaps an infinite number, but that in the Milky Way, in the 200 billion star systems that we have access to at some level, there could be only one. And I that's an interesting thing to turn around and say, well, therefore we're valuable. I mean, it could be that this is the only place in a galaxy where there's any meaning. And we talk about, you know, the kind of nonsensical versions of search for meaning and for Deepak and things like this. But actually, the undoubtedly meaning exists here on Earth because it means something to me. It means something to you. We have families, we love people, there's meaning here. So I think actually cosmology and biology and our view of the universe now can actually make us feel extremely valuable. And then that becomes almost political then, because you say, well, what should we do if we're the only place where there's an intelligent civilization amongst 200 billion stars in a galaxy? How should we look after ourselves? How should that knowledge inform our behavior? And so I think that cosmology is often misunderstood, and astronomy is often misunderstood. It's actually John Updike said it's what we now have instead of theology. It has less terror, but none of the comfort. Astronomy. But actually, maybe it does have comfort, because there's comfort in our possible rarity. I should say that if you're an astronomer, it's interesting. Talk to astronomers, then recently the Kepler data from the Kepler Space Telescope suggests that there are of order 20 billion Earth-like planets in the Milky Way galaxy. By Earth-like, I mean rocky, and in the right distance from the star to be
the Goldilocks
zone, habitable zone. Yeah. Yes. So whilst they might not be Earth-like, they're at least potentially Earth-like. The data suggests maybe 1 in 5 or 1 in 10 stars out of the 200 billion has a planet like that. So astronomers, the SETI community, for example, will say, well, look at that. And it's true. We've got data now that probably all stars pretty much have solar systems, and maybe 1 in 10 of them have Earth-like planets potentially around them. So therefore, life may be very common. And I would agree with that, actually. I would think life may well be common in the Milky Way. We may well find it on Mars within the next 10 years or so, or Jupiter's moon Europa. But then when you ask the question, what's the likelihood that simple life, single-celled things, will end up building a civilization? Then if you look at the history of life on Earth, it took nearly 4 billion years to go from the origin of life to... It took 3.5 billion years to get anything that you would recognize as complex, a multicellular organism. For 3 billion years, life was just single-celled things, admittedly doing interesting stuff like photosynthesis, quite complicated. So you might look at Earth and say, well, 4 billion years, that's a third of the age of the universe. So it's not the origin of life that's the problem. It may well be that transition from simple life to intelligent life and civilizations may
be
extremely unlikely.
Which would just be like accidental environmental mutation? Or?
Well, undoubtedly is. I mean, if you look at the story of the origin of Homo sapiens, humans, we only emerged about 200,000 years ago in the Rift Valley of Africa. And in fact, all the big jumps, there have been 3 or 4 jumps in the fossil record, as far as we can tell, in human a hominin brain size. So hominins are the things like Australopithecus, yes, that were around 4 million years ago, Homo erectus, those things, and then the things that Homo heidelbergensis that became Neanderthals and then Homo sapiens. All those jumps occurred in the Rift Valley, as far as we can tell. And that's reasonably well accepted. So there's something about the Rift Valley that's special, something about perhaps the way that climate shifts in the Rift Valley, the selection pressures in that place, that subtropical valley sort of moving down through Africa. So it seems that you needed not only our ancestors, the Australopithecines, which were basically upright chimpanzees, but you needed somewhere to apply pressure such that the
Australopithecus afarensis
was a...
Australopithecus afarensis.
That thing, yeah.
Yes.
Yeah,
yes.
There's a lot of Australopithecus. If you take about, honestly, if you say we're going to have a debate about hominin evolution, the details of it with a load of anthropologists, and you say, let's go meet in a pub somewhere, they won't even agree on the pub. they don't agree on anything. But the broad sweep is agreed upon.
Yes.
And so that's the broad sweep is that four million
this
years.
This is the skull of one anthropologist who killed this other anthropologist at the age of the skull.
Maybe that was it.
Is that the octopus talking?
maybe it was arguments between anthropologists that led to the increases in brain size.
Increased the number of skull fossils, I think.
So I know there was something down there that could have been something environmental that created something dietary, where they're either eating more protein, which is making their brain size increase.
Yeah, or... there's some suggestion that it's interesting that one of the big increases in brain size and in the number of hominin species, it happened 1.8 million years ago. There's a big increase. So there's five or six different. There's Australopithecus and Homo erectus and other things around at that time. And also the brain size increases. And that's correlated, actually, interestingly, with the time when the Earth's orbit was at its most elliptical. So the Earth's orbit oscillates in very complicated ways, actually, over 100,000-year timescales, 400,000-year timescales. And one of the big oscillations is a 400,000-year oscillation when it comes elliptical and then more circular, elliptical and more circular. And it's to do with resonances with Jupiter, gravitational interactions with Jupiter and other things. And then... So there's a theory that actually when the Earth's orbit's very elliptical, then it gets quite complicated. But the Earth's spin axis also precesses around every 20-odd thousand years or so and traces out an arc in the sky. And that's amplified. The effect of that on the climate is amplified when the orbit is elliptical. And it corresponds, interestingly, there's a correlation between increases in brain size in the Rift Valley and the times when the Earth's orbit is elliptical. So the theory is that the climate change, that the rapid climate change which appears to happen at those times, by rapid I mean over thousands of years, but relatively rapid, is a contributing factor to the increase in brain size. So then you're saying that means the structure of the solar system is important, which undoubtedly is. The fact that you've got this giant planet Jupiter in the right place to deflect a lot of asteroids, for example, but also to induce resonances in the Earth's orbit and changes which actually contributed to this evolutionary path. That suddenly you start thinking, if you're a biologist or anthropologist, well, this is we're lucky. We're so, so lucky to be here in this form.
Shit.
But maybe it's possible.
But I think it's also it also seems to become apparent that scientists of several different, I guess, seemingly disparate disciplines should all be communicating because of reasons like, you know, because if you're a biologist, maybe you're not thinking about, you know, like what the elliptical orbit structure of the Earth around. And so how it sounds like you cover a lot of different disciplines.
This is one of the big delights in making these documentaries, that you do that and you get to talk to academics from different disciplines. And it's true that work came from interdisciplinary research. And it's a legitimate criticism that we get put into silos. I mean, I'm a particle physicist that's my research. So that's a very niche area in a sense. You're very focused on a machine like the Large Hadron Collider.
Yes.
And then you do that work. But to bring one of the great goals of many universities now is to try and get these academics together. So don't have the biologists off in their building and the anthropologists, yes, you have to put them in a cage. Otherwise they get violent. But and the chemists and get everyone together, because you get jumps like this. Because an astronomer, if an astronomer sees a cycle, a 400,000-year cycle in some fossil record, they'll immediately go, well, actually, the Earth, one of the big cycles that happens in the Earth's orbit is 400,000 years. So is that correlated?
Wow.
And that's valuable.
Are you a big science fanatic?
I've been on the show twice.
So yes.
No, I'm a huge science fanatic, actually. Yeah, in an amateur way. Yes, I am, which fascinates me, because I wanted to know whether the climate became warmer and colder or just more extreme on the oscillations when it gets more, you know.
The data is actually, the best data is to do with lakes. They call them ephemeral lakes, so lakes that appear and disappear. Uh-huh. So it looks like a rainfall. One of the big pieces of data that fits in is a variation in rainfall, rapid variation in rainfall. One of the thing that's not agreed on, so the timescales that I've just spoken about are relatively well agreed. What's not agreed on is what possible selection mechanism could there be? Because remember, we're talking about a few thousand year variations, whereas Darwinian selection happens now. It happens to individuals and populations. So one of the theories is that there's a Garden of Eden in the Rift Valley at some of these times. It's raining, there's plentiful stuff, so the population increases. And then 1,000 years later, it's arid and dry. So you've got this big population challenged by the new aridity that happened. So that population, there's pressure on it. And could it be that then the more intelligent ones are more adaptable? Or could it be that there's a selection for the group, individuals that work in groups? So you get bigger tribes, because that's the way to survive this harsh onset of, you know, the years of plenty have gone and it's difficult to find food. So that's debated very heavily. So it's good to say what's speculation and what isn't. But there's a big academic debate about this at the moment.
I always kind of like to imagine, you know, what if we had a less intelligent cousin species that had survived? Like, what if there was...
Neanderthals were...
called the Republican Party.
Hey! Neanderthals, we certainly coexisted with Neanderthals, but whether they were less intelligent or not is a good question. Yeah. There's this kind of, you know, sort of folklore.
We interbred with them, didn't we?
Well, we did, yeah. And they were around, and it may have...
Yeah.
But the common myth, I think, that we... Well, he's like, yes.
We got in there. Yeah.
Look at that thing over there.
I like him strong.
Yeah. But the idea that they were somehow less intelligent is not actually supported. There's a lot of debate about that now. So it looks like there's no real basis to expect they were to think they were less intelligent than us. I know it's become this Neanderthal.
They have bigger brain size.
Yeah.
They have bigger cranium.
So is there a school of thought where they have just... blended in the population and just...
Well, they have this the DNA is, what is it, up to 3% or something like that.
But it's not, they're different enough that we don't, there's not like a direct, I mean, the ancestors are a bit farther back, I think, than you would assume.
What's thought is that there was a previous radiation. So the Homo sapiens got out of the Rift Valley, it's thought, around 60,000 years ago. So that's when our species left Africa, in numbers anyway. And they got into Europe about 43,000 years ago. Staggered into America about 15,000. I was saying it in Britain. I go, that explains a lot, doesn't it? And get a big laugh. But I shouldn't say that. But the Neanderthals were undoubtedly probably evolved in Northern Europe in that area. So they probably evolved from Homo heidelbergensis, which is a previous radiation out of Africa. That's what. But again, there's disagreement amongst anthropologists. But yeah, that's probably what happened.
Maybe they just started IKEA.
I think they did, and that explains why the furniture is named what it is. It's just like incoherent garble.
But they may have started painting, mightn't they? They're the ones that seem to be the hand painting.
Yeah, there's some cave paintings in northern Spain that have been dated. They're older than 41,000 years, and the reason you have to say that is because they date it by looking at the radioactive dating of the limestone that forms over the paintings. You can't date the pigment, it's too old, but you can date the formations over it, the limestone that runs down the cave walls. Oh, wow. So you know it's older than that. And it's interesting because some of these paintings are, as I say, older than 41,000 or so, and there's no evidence of Homo sapiens being in that region before about 43,000. So there's a very tight... It could have been that these paintings were Homo sapiens, the first ones, or it could have been they were Neanderthals that were doing cave art in Europe. It's hotly debated at the moment, but it's interesting. So they could have been on the way to a civilization. They could have been on the way. These ideas, there were ideas in their heads, there's representational art in these caves that could have been from them and not us.
I think so much of the... it really does... I had a moment a couple of weeks ago where I really... Because, you know, I'll read science blogs and I just kind of breeze over them. Go, okay, they discovered this dinosaur, you know, this species that they thought that was brand new. Oh, it was a new dinosaur species and he existed, you know, for 15 million years. And you kind of read that and it's sort of disposable information. And then I go, we don't really want to think about the idea of 15 million years of something being around 15 million years. And that, you know, we're just an infinitesimal speck.
Oh, it's incredible that if you think that Homo sapiens got out of Africa 60,000 years ago, and by, you know, not long after that, we start seeing the origins of agriculture and civilization emerges pretty quickly. So we've been 200,000 years from emergence as a species to walking on the moon. That's not bad.
Does it seem like a switch just flicked and all of a sudden, man...
Well, it seems like these step changes in brain size are relatively quick. It's about over 4 million years or so since you get the first Australopithecus afarensis, as you said. And that's basically a chimpanzee, an upright chimpanzee. So you seem to go pretty quick once it starts. But then, the interesting thing is, before that, you have 3.8 billion years of, you know, complexity, but not anything you'd call intelligent in terms of civilization.
So how much are we affecting our own future evolution with technology and...
We're huge. We're fast. I mean, the reason all this interdisciplinary stuff is possible is because of the computer, which starts in 1990. And now the growth of science and everything all comes from that, because you can just be reading science. We can read it suddenly. It's in the news. It's extraordinary, and it puts everything together. Information is absolutely available for us to share. So that's why I think we've had this huge explosion of knowledge.
Yeah. Although it concerns me a bit.
Right? AI is coming. We're going to be fucked. Robots are going to kill us, right?
There's a great... I'm going to happen. I'm going to plug a film that a friend of mine wrote, Alex Garland, who wrote 28 Days Later. So you might know that, right? But he's got a great film called Ex Machina that's just... Have you seen it?
I think I saw Ex Machina.
It's out in the UK. It's out here, I think, in April, I believe.
Then I haven't seen it.
It's about an AI.
Is that with Chappie?
No, it's not Chappie. Oh. Who's in it?
What's he called?
Is Antonio Banderas in it?
No.
I saw an AI movie.
Oh, that was Zorro.
No. I saw an AI movie starring Antonio Banderas that was like, you know, that a machine became self-aware that in this world it was kind of... It was really kind of an iRobot.
Yeah. Well, what does it presuppose?
This is a great film. The idea is that the AI is a beautiful woman, and she's been created by this guy who's kind of like an Elon Musk type character. I think he got his money from inventing a search engine in the film, and he lives out in the woods, and he's a genius, and he's got this AI. And the kind of conceit is, so he gets someone from his company to come, and he wants him to do a Turing test on her, which is the idea that how would you know this thing was conscious?
Right.
You'd interact with it, talk to it, and if you perceive it to be conscious, then it's conscious. And so the film develops from there. So you want to know, why is this a beautiful woman that he's created? And you might guess why you might create a beautiful woman. But it's a great film, actually. Yeah. But here's Alex's point. I talked to him a lot about it, and his idea,
the boners.
Yeah,
sciencey is things.
That's what drives the web, isn't it? But the idea is that he thinks that they will be better than us. He says that a lot. They will be better than us. The things that we create, these conscious robots, our future, that these things will be. We should celebrate the fact that they will be more capable, more intelligent, more physically capable. They are the future of the human race, and he thinks that's great.
I'm with that.
I am too. I've always thought it was a fascinating idea that we, you know, in order to speed up the next phase of evolution, that we create the thing that is that, or we create the thing that hastens that.
You can also travel, time travel. It can go off for 100,000 years. It doesn't die.
Yeah.
So, you know, you could have a personality based on you that talked a bit like Brian, you know, programmed with all of his thoughts and looking like him, but it could go off and emerge in 200,000 years somewhere else.
That leads to an interesting thing, though. You go back to cosmology and life in the universe. There's a thing called the Fermi paradox, which is named after Enrico Fermi.
Fermi Lab.
Fermi Lab,
I've been.
I used to work there, actually.
You did?
Yeah.
Just happened to be driving by one day when I was touring and doing touring comedy in Illinois, and the exit for Batavia was right there. I'm like, oh my God, that's Fermilab.
Yeah.
And I was writing for Wired magazine at the time, so I just drove up and I'm like, I work for Wired and I'm just here to maybe do a story. And they said, come on in. Gave us a tour, and they said, we're shutting down soon because CERN is going to take over. But they showed us the whole... It was incredible.
Yeah, Tevatron. It's an incredible machine. It's one of the only ones you can see. It's on the surface because there's a lot of room there. You know, so it's not like in Europe where you have to build them underground. So you can see the lake.
You can see the lake. Yeah, you can see everything. They took us up in the building so you could see everything. Okay, so I'm sorry. So the Fermi paradox.
But a Fermi paradox is essentially that Fermi's real question was, where are they? Right, where are the civilizations? Because if you look at the galaxy, so the Milky Way galaxy has been around pretty much for the age of the universe, you know, 12 billion, 13 billion years or something, there's been a galaxy here. 200 billion stars, we said, with many planets, a huge amount of time for life to develop and civilizations to emerge on other planets. And if you get to the point, you might say, well, they die out. Biological civilizations, they die. But if you get to the point where you can build self-replicating machines, so if you accept the fact that you can build an AI, so there's nothing special about consciousness, if you have a sufficiently powerful computer, you can do it. And you can build a self-replicator. We can build 3D printers already, so we're not far off. We can build printers that print parts for the printers. So it's not impossible to imagine give us 1,000 years from now. Give us probably 100, but give us 1,000. You could imagine we could build replicating AIs. And then, as Eric said, you've got these things that can go out into the, let's say go into the asteroid belt, do a bit of mining, rebuild, go off again.
It's called the Borg, guys.
They're called von Neumann machines after the mathematician von Neumann who studied it. But you can show that with even with our technology or conceivable technology, you can cover the Milky Way galaxy with these things, these probes, these intelligence-gathering things or whatever you call them, in timescales of 100,000 years or so, certainly 1,000,000 years, let's say.
Have you been watching?
But 1,000,000 years is nothing.
Right. No,
that's the
right.
point. So the question, where are they, I think is quite a profound one. And the answer might be, the answer to that paradox might be, it could be that we can't build those things. It could be there's a problem with AI that we haven't seen and it's difficult to build. I don't think so, though, actually. It could be, actually, more likely, I think, that civilizations are just rare. So to get to the point where your biology is complex enough and your intelligence is complex enough that you can build these things is just so rare that we might be
alone. Themselves too, because there was also the theory that 9 out of 10 civilizations approaching nuclear power would actually destroy themselves.
Sure.
Yeah, well, we
which
had
is rather good
try.
Because it means that the only ones to survive are the fittest to survive.
Yeah, there's a philosophical idea called the great filter, which is so you can say, if it's true that there are very few, if any, civilizations, is the filter in our past. So that would be like a biological filter. Mm. Is it that it's just complex life is so unlikely that we pass through the filter? So we actually are. We're here and we're going to be there. Or is the filter in our future? Could it be that at this point where you have your nuclear weapons and you get to the point where you've got to manage your civilization, you've got climate change and those things, you threaten your environment. Could it be that the filter is there and it's just difficult to get through, and so we're not going to get through it? Could that be the reason that we don't see any evidence of any other civilization?
Well, it is. I think part of the challenge would be creating the machine and then getting the machine just past the hump where it could then take it from there and figure out whatever we couldn't. You know, it's like, I've taught you all I can, and then the machine would have to take over. And then, of course, realize that we were pointless and then use us as food. But
you think it's
or fuel or what have you.
Batteries like the Matrix.
What do you think of the idea of this theory that perhaps everything we know is essentially like a simulation?
Well, essentially, it's not as wild as you might. That's another answer to this, that there were actually other civilizations. Again, it's based on the idea that if you look at our computer technology and the trajectory of it, then if you carry on, then it looks like we could simulate relatively real worlds in the not-too-distant future. And then, so it might be statistically likely that actually we do live in a simulation because that would be... Because we'll be doing it. Yeah. And it's true, you know, give us... Let's say we survive. Give us... Our civilization's been around for at most 10,000 years. The technological civilization, you could say, dates back to Newton, let's say, arguably, so 1680s, when you get modern science. And so in 300 years, 350 years, we go from Newton to the moon and to building Voyager that leaves the solar system. We've got spacecraft out there in interstellar space. We've got computing power like we couldn't imagine. This is 400 years. Give us 10,000, double the length of time. What are our computers going to look like? Well, they could simulate reality. Extremely powerfully, you would think.
I mean, at one time...
So people may... I don't necessarily subscribe to this view. I there's no evidence for that. It's more of a philosophical standpoint, but it's kind of interesting at least to accept the fact that if the point is, I think it's missed a lot. People think this is wild stuff. But the point is, could you imagine us doing it in 10,000 years? And the answer is yes.
Yeah, of course.
Sure. Could. So therefore, why didn't somebody else do it? Or perhaps they did, is the kind of logic.
Well, I mean, you know, essentially, we're talking about technology basically shortening distances. So the idea of, you know, at one time the ocean being, oh, well, how would you ever get across that? And then, you know, people figured it out. And then time being a distance, you know, like, well, if you can bend time, if you can control, then you could travel to, you know, you could travel across the universe.
Well, you can. I mean, you can bend time in that sense, because the Einstein tells us the closer you get to the speed of light, the slower your clock ticks.
You wrote a whole book about that.
Why does E equals MC squared? Available from DiCapo Press. Yes, it's very. Thank you, Brad.
Of course,
get it on Amazon. Use the Nerdist link.
Yeah,
oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Everyone's plugging everything.
That's right. But you're right. So the number I always have in my head is for the protons at the Large Hadron Collider. So they go around that 16-mile in circumference accelerator 11,000 times a second, which is 99.999999% the speed of light. Jeez. And at that speed, time passes 7,000 times more slowly for the protons than it does for the experimenter sat there watching them go round. 7,000. So that's a big effect. And so you might say, well...
So the proton is in agony because it's just bored for
Because you see, but the corollary of that is, well, yeah, but what does it look like for the proton? If the proton had a wristwatch, what would a proton's wristwatch look like? But if it had a wristwatch, it would see time pass at the normal rate.
Yeah. Right.
So what? But something has to change, though. And what changes is the distance. So the LHC ring is not 16 miles in circumference. It's about 12 feet in circumference to the protons. So the flip side is, so distances shrink as you approach the speed of light in your reference frame. Mm. Time passes more slowly in a different reference frame. And this is the way the universe is constructed. So the reason we find that weird is because we talk about distances in space and distances in time, when actually what Einstein discovered is that's not right. They're not observable quantities everyone agrees on. What everyone does agree on is distances in space-time. So you've got to change. You've got to change to saying, what's the distance between my alarm clock going off in the morning in my bedroom and me making my toast in the kitchen at 1 hour later? There's a distance in Einstein's theory between those two events. So it's distances in space and time together between events. And everyone agrees on that. That's the key point about Einstein's theory.
I saw a special with Michio Kaku. Mm-hmm. And they had different people in the street count out what they thought was 60 seconds. And they found, at least according to what they said, that younger people calculated it differently than older people. That there seemed to be some sort of a, you know, when you're younger, you perceive time a different way.
He wasn't an old one. They'd be going, one. You've got to be in a city where people can actually count to 60. Yeah. Did you think of that? I should say that. I love Oldham.
But I mean, you know, how much of it bleeds into just our day-to-day perception and the idea that, you know, because my dad, the older my dad got, he'd go, years are turning into months and months are turning into days. And it's just, when I was younger, I'm like, you're a crazy old man. But now as I'm starting to get older, I can't believe it's 2015. It just felt like it was 2014. Is there something biological in the way that we perceive time that erodes or changes over time?
There is, undoubtedly, but that's relativity is completely different to that. This is built in. This is the same for a proton as it is for a living being. It's a time genuinely is a thing that you don't speak of on its own. The universe is not built like that. So it's kind of a prejudice of ours, mm-hmm. that we see space and time as different things. And in Einstein's theory, indeed, they're almost the same. They're not quite the same. It's a theory of a four-dimensional universe. So time is a dimension like space in Einstein's theory. But of course, we don't have freedom of movement through time. We have a bit of freedom in the speed we go into the past, the speed we go into the future relative to somebody else. We have complete freedom, actually. If we move fast relative to other people, we can slow our clocks down relative to them, vice versa. But we can't get into the past. So it's not it's a slight difference in the geometry, because obviously we don't have freedom of movement in time.
Sure.
That's the only difference, though, in Einstein's theory.
You tried just sending the particle the other way. Does that work?
Well, we do send them
in Australia. It goes the other way. Yeah, in Australia.
They can go back in time in Australia, just not up here.
Yeah, LHC. We go both in the LHC, actually. We go one way, one the other way, then collide them together.
You're trying to smash them into one another.
Well, we succeed. 600 million times a second.
Oh, my gosh.
And recreate conditions that were present less than a billionth of a second.
So what does the data look like when that happens? What is it that you're pouring it through?
It's a terrific mess, because it would be great if we could collide one proton into one proton at a time. But on the average, we collide 30 or 35 at a time, actually. So it's a tremendous mess, because only in one of those collisions, if you're very lucky, will anything interesting happen. And in very few of them will something like a Higgs particle be produced, which is what you're looking for. So the rest of it is a tremendous mess. And so the difficulty, the skill in particle physics, is taking these essentially digital photographs of this big mess. Because when you smash two protons together at almost the speed of light, these huge energies that were present, as I said, characteristic of the universe as it was less than a billionth of a second after the Big Bang, you make a lot of new particles, you can imagine. It's a big bang, right? And so it's a mess, hundreds of particles all in the detector. And the trick is you write essentially computer code to go through those millions, hundreds of millions of events, hundreds of millions of collisions, and try and sort out the ones that are interesting. We're looking for... In that case, we were looking for the Higgs particle. We didn't know exactly what it looked like or what it would decay into. We had predictions about how it would behave. We didn't know what mass it was. So you're looking for something that you don't know exists,
right,
in a mess of millions of collisions and trying to sort through. And so that's the difficulty in particle physics.
I read
but we found it.
We did find it, ultimately. And the universe did not implode. And not implode when it...
Was always bollocks. What we didn't... No, and we still don't know precisely, is this exactly the Higgs particle that's predicted by the so-called standard model, which is what Peter Higgs got the Nobel mm-hmm. Prize for? Is it exactly that? The LHC turns on actually next month again.
Oh, it does?
With an energy upgrade, it's back up to close to it, if not at its energy that it was designed to be at. It ran at half energy when it discovered the Higgs. So it's up with a big factor in energy. So the idea now is to make a lot of Higgs particles and analyze them in detail. We want to know exactly how they behave. How does it talk to the other particles? Is it this standard model Higgs? There are theories called supersymmetric theories where there are five Higgs particles rather than one, for example. We don't think that that's what this thing is. We think it's on its own, but we don't know exactly. So we've got a lot of work to do now to characterize it. It's a new thing. It's like a new planet.
Are you going to get in the collider to try to get superpowers, or does it not work that way? Like Dr. Manhattan asks superpowers over.
That's classified.
Okay. I shouldn't ask that question. Maybe like 5 or 6 years ago, I read a book called The God Particle, which I think it was Leon Lederman.
Yeah, he won a Nobel Prize.
And it took a while for me to get through because I am not a scientist. And the problem that I was having is that obviously when you usually associate when you're reading something, oh, this is and it's very fast. You can usually do it very quickly. This is analogous to this or this is it. But you're reading about quantum physics and the particles and the way, and that I couldn't connect it to anything. So I kept having to stop and go, I think it's like this, and I'm trying to envision it, and it hurt my brain.
Quantum theory is we talk about it a lot. I talk about it with Eric a lot because it's an interesting. It's a counterintuitive theory, but the thing to remember about it is it's 100 years old. It's very mature. It describes correctly the behavior of every experiment we've seen. Every phenomenon in the universe other than gravity is described at its most basic level by a quantum theory. So the way that a transistor works is understood by using quantum theory, for example, and they work. So it's not. It's kind of esoteric in the sense that it's a bit difficult, but it's well understood. There are questions about how you interpret quantum theory and where we go next, but I think that it's often, I think the difficulty is conceptual rather than technical. I often think it should be taught in schools, actually, really genuinely. Not the mathematics can be a bit tricky, although not too tricky actually. We teach it in first year physics; it's not horrendous, but the concepts I think are understandable, but challenging. And a lot of the confusion comes from concepts that you could discuss with 10-year-olds. Right? There's nothing inherently difficult. It's just that you've got to understand that how do you describe an electron? Let me describe it this way. So what it's a particle, right? But what's the mathematical description of it? Well, it's something called a wave function. So what's that? Well, it's basically like describing the temperature in the room that we're in now. So it's like that's called a field in physics jargon. So what's the temperature in this room? Well, at every point in the room, you could have a number which tells you the temperature. So it's an extended object, a big array of numbers, if you like. And the description of electrons is the same. So it's not a point-like thing in quantum theory. It's described by a field, essentially. And it's described by this thing called the wave function, which is basically a number at every point. It's a thing called a complex number, so it's a bit different. It's got two bits to it, but it's basically a number. And the numbers tell you the probability that you can find the electron. You will find the electron in that region of space. So that's all there is to quantum theory. It's a strange thing because it's an extended description of a particle. But the key, the trouble comes interpreting it by what you mean by the probability to find it somewhere. So what do you mean by that? What does it mean to say, well, the electron is has a 25% chance of being over here and a 75% chance of being over there? That's the way the mathematics works. But what does that mean for reality? What it means is if you get 100 identical electrons and stick them in this room now, and you go and you measure one of them, you say, where are you? And you might find that it's in one corner. And then you set it all up exactly the same, set the whole thing up again, come in, measure it, say, where are you? Then you'll find it somewhere else. And then you come in again, set it all up the same, measure it again, you'll find it somewhere else. And if you count all those probabilities up, just like tossing a coin, then you'll get this wave function out. That's what you'll get. So that's the description of the particle. The key thing is, what do I mean by measure it? What do I mean by that? Because if you bounce a particle in and then interact with the electron, you get another wave function, which is still a big ensemble of probabilities.
You might have lost another 10-year-old by this point.
You get another ensemble of probabilities. I would have. No, I've raised it to the level of the podcast now. I don't know.
Okay, good.
So the key thing is, what do you mean? So you get problems about what you mean by measure. Do you mean, is it something to do with me extracting knowledge from this thing or whatever? But the theory itself, the mathematics works, the description works. Every experiment we've ever done at a particle, any particle collider like Fermilab or CERN, is in agreement with the predictions of quantum theory. So it works, but it's a bit odd because
Why is the behavior so different than anything else? Like, is there what is?
Well, it's not. The point is that this is the way the universe behaves. So the nature behaves like this. The description of nature, the correct description, as far as we know, is quantum theory. The fact that we don't perceive a quantum world is the interesting question,
right?
And that's where you. Where our knowledge, you know, the proper answer to that is we don't know why we don't. There are theories that can suggest, and there are interpretations of quantum theory that can suggest why we feel we live in this concrete Newtonian world of particles and solid things that are in one place at once and not 10 places at once. But actually, the description of this world that works best is a description that tells you things can be in 10 places at once or an infinite number of places at once.
That's why transporters will work.
Well, teleportation works.
Yeah.
So we do that. You know that's true.
Is there a sub-quantum world?
Can I just qualify that? Because I'm just conscious of the fact people are listening going, teleportation works?
Right.
It works for single particles.
It's been done for single particles.
No one knows how big
scalable that is.
But it does work for photons.
Pretty soon we're going to transport Dr. McCoy off.
You're not? No? Dr. McCoy is just going to get
Star Trek's real.
Going to get horribly burned.
Is warp speed possible? Can we warp space and go faster than light? Can we do that?
I doubt it.
All right, fine.
You've just ruined it.
No, it's
well, you could build a time machine then.
A TARDIS.
You could build a time machine. Yeah. So
if you could warp space, then you would invert. You would also.
Yeah, there's there's a paper by Hawking actually that years ago I asked him about it. We met Stephen, myself and Eric in his office.
What? We filmed him last year.
What?
Yeah. Yeah, the Python reunion. I persuaded Brian to do a joke. And I said, ask Stephen Hawking if he'd do it. And he told me back. Right? He said, in 10 seconds. He said, yes. So we found ourselves heading up to Cambridge filming. And it came after the Galaxy song, and Brian came on the screen. He said, now, the reason I find some of this stuff is problematic is all the sun is not the source of all our power. And he starts bullshitting about the song being
bullshitting.
Wrong. Being criticizing
correct.
The song.
I was just
there.
Everything I said was wrong.
There behind him appears this wheelchair coming at great speed. And as he's going on, it comes slam straight into Brian, knocks him flying, and it's Hawking goes off singing the universe song in space.
Amazing. Yeah.
And he came to the last show. And we're about to release him singing Galaxy Song. It says Stephen Hawking sings Monty Python.
And where is that?
It'll be on Singles Day in April. There'll be
this.
So we had a lovely day. He says, how amazing. We went up to Cambridge. We met the most brilliant man in the world. And we filmed a stupid joke.
It was completely Python-esque. It reminded me of that sketch. What is the sketch where you have Mao Tse-Tung and everybody there?
Yes.
And you ask him who won the Eurovision Song Contest in 1963.
Yes.
Not interested in asking.
Do you feel some pressure when you're around Hawking to be like, I should ask him something that I need to know?
I did. That's what I would. So I asked him about, there's a paper he wrote called The Chronology Protection Conjecture, which is, although in principle it's true that in Einstein's theory, you can. It seems you may be able to build wormholes. So these, you know, warp space and time in such a way that you can hop around the universe almost instantly to great distances. And that's what Interstellar is based on. I haven't seen Interstellar, actually, but Kip Thorne, who advised Interstellar, is one of the greats in general relativity. So it's so in principle, that seems to be true. But it does allow you to have problems with time travel into the past. Mm-hmm. And so Hawking proposed that any theory of gravity, that the future theory of quantum gravity, will be such that you can't build these things, stable wormholes, and anything that allows you to, in principle, get into the past would be forbidden. The laws of physics would not allow it. But it's true to say that at the moment there's an ambiguity there in Einstein's theory that it seems you could. It's true, some sort of matter that doesn't exist, some kind of strange sort of configuration of matter and energy that we don't think exists in nature. But in principle, you could build these wormhole things.
So
I asked him about that.
And how does he respond? Does it take a minute to form the, or does he have an assistant?
So it takes a while. So the way to talk to Stephen, if you can, is to just yes or no answers are easy for him. So you can have a good conversation with him, actually. And in fact, there's an ad lib, isn't there, in the Python?
Well, yeah, whilst he was asking himself obtuse question, he was doing all the thing where he writes, you know, with his eyes and his things. And then he was actually ad libbing a gag, which we used because we filmed it for what he said after Brian. He hits Brian, which is like, "You're being way too pedantic."
Yeah.
And that was his ad lib. It came out. This is great. And luckily we had the camera, we had it running, so we taped it. You know, it was great. He's really more interested in comedy, Stephen, actually. He came to the last night's show, and Brian and I, he came to the party office, and I went over to him and I said, "I think you, me, and Brian have a great future in comedy."
You should, too.
Yeah. By the way, was
actually his little corner of his mouth rises. It's great.
Did you have fun doing those shows, by the way?
Yeah.
Was it all right?
Yeah. It was fine. It's good fun. Yeah.
Good.
Of course.
Good.
Yeah. Again, you get to days filming with Stephen Hawking.
What a strange life.
Yes, it is.
What do you guys talk about when you're discussing quantum mechanics? Do you ask him questions or do you
him?
Yeah. What do you guys talk about?
Range. I'm a very well read layman. I mean, I know everything. I mean, nothing about everything really. So I can ask him anything. He's of interest to me, and he's a very good explainer.
Answer. Often I can't answer because you're right. You showed me the latest. I arrived on when was it? Saturday, I think. And you gave me the latest article about the new Planck data, the cosmic microwave background data. Which I hadn't seen, and so I got it from Eric. And
BBC website. It's like,
well done.
Yeah. Yes.
But it's very new data that suggests that stars formed later than we had thought in the history of the universe, which you can see from the...
Was it about was it 100 million years, or was it... I know what you're talking about.
Yeah, I can't remember the exact number, but I think it's a little bit later than was previously thought.
Yeah.
I mean, it's one of the big questions. We were talking about this, actually, about galaxies and supermassive black holes at the centre of galaxies and whether they're necessary for the formation. Again, it was a question I couldn't answer because nobody knows, I think. We were talking about that last night, about how galaxies form. And it's one of the great open questions, actually, how galaxies form. What role does dark matter play in that? Probably a big role. The black hole at the centre of the Milky Way is about 4 million solar masses. So how did that get there? Well, does that form first somehow at the same time as the galaxy? Not known.
Does it bother you that a lot of this you will never know?
No, I think that's I think the key to being a scientist is to delight in not knowing. It's to stand on the edge of the known and face the unknown with curiosity and delight and not fear. I think that's one of the great problems we have in our society, actually. I think it's when people are afraid of not of saying we don't know. So when you ask questions like, what happened before the Big Bang, let's say? Well, we have some theories. It sometimes gets a bit into semantics, this, but we have theories of inflationary cosmology that suggest there was a time before the universe was hot and dense, mm-hmm. which we call the Big Bang, where there's this exponential expansion of space. But I think the what you get, if people react to that and say, well, you're playing God or something, you're trying, you know, and have a... get upset about cosmology. I think it's because people are afraid of the delight of saying there are things we don't know. Full stop. I'm not going to go therefore, I'm going to guess. You know,
yeah.
I don't know. We don't know this. So we think that, you know, this happened. That's a human disease born of fear, I think. I think that the great thing is to say, I don't know. But I'll try and find out.
I'll try to find out.
I'll have a look. But yeah. I'd be happy not knowing. Feynman always said that. Richard Feynman always has wonderful quotes about him saying that he delighted in not knowing. Someone asked him once, are you after a great theory of everything? And he said, no, I'm not after that. I don't know. I just look at bits of nature, little pieces of nature, little things catch my attention. Why are leaves green or something like that? You know?
Yeah.
And I'll just investigate that. And if I find out something quite profound, then so be it. And if I don't, then so be it. I just want to. I'm curious.
How important of a role do you think philosophy plays into like stirring into the science?
we have fun with this, don't we? I always say none.
Well, it's all philosophy, really. Isn't science natural philosophy? Isn't that what it was called?
Yeah, it was
natural philosophy. It just happened to have some figures at the end of it, as opposed to regular philosophy, which is just bullshit in the middle.
I quite like in the Human Universe book, actually, which is available. Leibniz said an interesting. I wrote about Leibniz because he had an argument for the existence of God, proof for the existence of God, which if I remember, and we'll get letters now. Do any philosophers listen to this?
Yes.
Did he?
Some. 10.
They know how to turn on the radio.
Do they do they not listen? they're not sure.
They know how to download things. It's progress. But so Leibniz, as far as I know, to summarise, said right, so everything that exists has to have a cause or it has to be logically necessary, and if it's logically necessary, then it must be eternal because it must have always been logically necessary. Mm-hmm. So there are two categories of things: things that are necessary and therefore always existed, and things that aren't necessary and therefore must have had a cause. So the universe is finite in age, as far as we can tell. Might not be, but the most common interpretation of the data is it's finite in age. Therefore, it had a cause, and the cause must have been something that's eternal. Because otherwise we have this infinite regress, and so we'll call that thing God, is his basic line of argument. And I think there's something interesting there if you're talking about, because not the God bit, but the bit about the, well, it's not sufficient to say, well, the universe just popped into existence. I think that's kind of Leibniz was right. That's not right. That philosophically, it doesn't make any sense to say that you need a mechanism, and if you have a mechanism, then that mechanism must always have been there. You know, so you can start thinking like that. And I think that's quite useful, actually. And in fact, although this is not why inflationary cosmology exists, inflationary cosmology exists because the data suggests that you could have this theory. But I think it's interesting. I think Leibniz would have quite liked it because it does give you the potential to have something that was always there, which is this inflating universe. And then it gives the potential for that to transform into something that looks like our Big Bang. And whether it did that all at once or whether it does it in little patches, giving rise to this thing we call an inflationary multiverse, where there are an infinite number, essentially, of universes like ours, and they're being produced all the time. This is a theory called eternal inflation, is interesting. But it's kind of, so I think philosophy does have a place because it at least stops you saying silly things. It stops you just being content with just saying, well, it's all right, the Big Bang, fine.
Well, what's
that's clearly not fine. Clearly we don't have a proper scientific understanding of what happened before that hot, dense phase, let's say, or what happened to create.
What is outside the universe?
Well, the standard answer is nothing, because space-time is the thing that, in standard Big Bang cosmology, came into existence at that point. So space-time, the arena itself, you're not to think of the universe as an arena in which galaxies float around like a big box.
Mm-hmm.
Einstein tells us you think of the space and time itself, the fabric, there's a fabric of the universe. That's the thing that's doing the stretching at the moment. And that's the thing that redshifts the light from galaxies. It's the stretching of the arena, if you like, of the space-time, of the fabric itself. As the universe goes on, which stretches the light.
Outside of the arena is a parking lot.
Nope. So too literal.
But in the inflationary cosmology, then we are sort of riding on the back of a exponentially expanding space-time that could have always been there. There's even an argument about that, because there's some theorems suggest maybe it couldn't have always been there. So we get technical then. Geodesic completeness. I have no idea what that means. So I just keep shouting it out. So I'm going to shout it out later.
Geodesic completeness?
I'm just going to go to the waiter and go, geodesic completeness.
He'll bring you
see
a Diet
if anyone
Coke.
Can tell me what that means. But apparently it suggests that maybe the universe couldn't have been around forever, but I don't know.
Well, as we're sort of gliding this in, that was an hour. That flew by.
Well,
can you believe it?
Was it?
It was an hour. Yeah, an hour and 4 minutes.
That is it.
Holy shit.
I know.
It's gin time.
Gin time for you, Brian. You've been talking and you need a gin and tonic.
What?
Yeah. Four cities. Well, before we get to the promo part.
The only reason. Shunning moment.
Yes. Available from all good ticket outlets.
I think you'll find the gas that has been pumped into the room makes it quite difficult to breathe. And then we all what is your favorite scientific principle? Like, just one scientific principle that you think underscores sort of the beauty of humanity and science, and something that you keep going back to and maybe think about over and over again.
Would you like my second favorite?
Yes.
My first was silence, obviously.
Yeah, of course. Yes, of course. Do you have something that you just...
I'm one of these people who like to look at the universe without necessarily getting telescopes and going, oh, that's that. So I spend a lot of time in the summer drinking pink wine and looking at the universe because I find it very reassuring that the immensity of the Milky Way and just where we are makes us feel very small and insecure indeed. Mm. So I find science very reassuring because it's actually things you can read about and learn about and understand. And as opposed to, you know, literature or philosophy or even music, which are things you make up and feel, there's something real there that you can understand.
Yeah, and it's challenging. It's challenging for human beings, I think, to seek answers because a lot of times you might find out things that are counter to your beliefs, and you have to be able to deal with that.
So all science, it's prefaced by the statement, of course, we might be wrong. That's the key to science. And I have to think it would be wonderful if every system of thought, every political system, every utterance anybody made, if Genesis started, well, of course we might be wrong, but in the beginning,
I
God
think the wedding
him.
Service should start with that.
Of course, we might be wrong, but we
which
are
would
gathered
render
here
the
today.
Following ceremony completely inert. But let's do this.
So, you should ask him where they're going to be performing.
What four cities are you going to be in, Brian?
Are we going to be in New York City on the
Tuesday the 13th or whatever.
No, we're going to be in LA. We'll go backwards.
Sure.
We're going to be in San Francisco on Friday the 13th of March.
All right.
We're going to be talking about SETI. We've got Seth Shostak, who's one of the great founding fathers of SETI, and Karen Porco.
Oh!
You've had Carolyn on the podcast.
I know. She's never been on the podcast, but of course I know who she is. And I've been to the... I went to the biosphere in I think it's in Arizona.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, she's one. So we're going to talk about what we've been talking about, alien life. Is it possible? Just single cell? Kind of, all that stuff. LA, which is the day before, 12th of March at the...
Ricardo Montalban.
Someone told me the guy from
Star Trek 2, The Wrath of Khan. And Fantasy Island, Ricardo Montalban.
Don't do Fantasy Island. Star Trek 2, The Wrath of Khan.
Yeah, he's Khan. He initially played Khan in the original series, then he came back and revised his role as Khan in the Star Trek 2.
Him.
And then Cumberbatch.
So his theatre.
And also, he is also the peddler of fine Corinthian leather.
That's a car commercial in America.
Yeah.
And we're going to have, amongst other guests, Sean Carroll is going to be on that. You know, Sean Carroll is a cosmologist. He's great. You should have him on this podcast.
Okay.
Brilliant. I had an online argument. I met him through having an argument about causality in quantum field theory online. Because he took exception to something I said in a lecture, and we had a big argument, and then thought, yeah, this is cool.
Who won? Did you school him?
I won in the sense that I wrote a research paper to answer with three colleagues, which is called Manifest Causality in Quantum Field Theories. But it's extremely technical and complicated, and I'm not sure any of us really understand it, although we published it, so you can get it. So there's more work to be done to see.
Okay, so LA the 12th, San Francisco the 13th.
Yeah, and then the week before we're in New York and Chicago.
New York on the 5th,
Chicago
on the 7th.
Yeah, and we're going to talk about paleontology in Chicago, And we're going to be talking about, we've got Neil deGrasse Tyson amongst other people in New York. And we're going to be talking about just science, that's the wonder of science, really.
Well, I think it's incredibly important that there are people in the world who can communicate science.
Oh, and Eric might sneak in LA as well.
Eric's going to sneak in.
Eric's going to sneak in.
Yeah, but that's the other good thing is they have comedians. Each time they have two comedians. Yeah.
Right.
So I've done it with Stephen Fry and, you know.
We haven't announced all our comedians yet. Yeah. We've got Maima Bialik as well.
Bialik,
She's coming to the LA show.
Excellent.
She's got a PhD, actually.
She is, yeah, in neuroscience, I think, right?
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, mm-hmm.
So she's going to do it.
Nice.
David Cohn, who Futurama.
Futurama.
Simpsons.
Yeah. Futurama is one of the smartest shows on television.
David X. Cohn, sorry.
Yeah.
So we have an eclectic mixture of guests, some of which we haven't announced yet, but
that's
it's
fantastic.
All going
to
be.
Well, this was an absolutely stimulating and wonderful honor to have you on the show. Brian Cox, and
you
have many books that people, there's the one about humanity and the one about quantum...
The quantum universe. Yeah, in there was one of the things I started arguing with Sean about. So there's some stuff in there.
I like that so much of this is scientists arguing with each other and betting against each other and trying to one-up each other.
You just lost a bet to me, though, didn't you?
I lost a bet, yeah. I said that Manchester United, I felt, were going to come second in the league. And if they did come second in the league, then I would buy... Eric, a bottle of Dom Runar 2004 champagne. And Eric had to buy me a bottle if they did come second. And unfortunately, one hour later, they lost. No, they drew, didn't they? They drew against West Ham. You have no idea what I'm talking about, have you?
Nah.
You're just looking at me going,
soccer ball.
Yeah, so now I don't think they're going to come second.
By the way, I'm very atypical. I don't understand any sports, so it's not just that it's a foreign sport.
It's all right. It's any sport.
Yeah. It's any sport. Period.
But I feel like you would be like into English Premier League soccer,
like
that's your one sport.
I don't think so.
Well, cricket.
It's not going to get. It's going to be cricket.
Yeah,
which to me is about as easy to understand as quantum mechanics.
Yeah, it's very similar.
Yeah. But thanks for being here. And Eric, thank you for sitting in.
My pleasure.
Eric just happened to come along with Brian. And of course, we had to
sit. And now they must go drink.
It's a delight. Thank you for having me.
It's kind of funny, watching scientists one-up each other the way that comics one-up each other with jokes. It's like, well, I'm going to one-up you with a research paper instead of a simple dick joke. Well done, Mr. Cox. Mr. Idle, nice to see you. Enjoy your burrito, everyone.
Thank you very much.
Now leaving Nerdist.com. Enjoy your burrito.
How powerful is Cox Internet? Powerful enough to let your band members in Vegas, Phoenix, and Rhode Island jam like you're all in the same garage. Get gig speeds powered by fiber from Cox. It's internet built for tomorrow, today. Cox, always building better. Download speeds up to 1 gigabit per second. Cox Internet is connected to the premises via coaxial connection. Speeds vary and are not guaranteed. Cox terms and other restrictions may apply.